Good Monday morning. Hope your day's off to a pretty good start so far, coming up to 10:07. Hi, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rakow with you until 12:30 this afternoon, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. It is time now for Science Files, and joining me this morning to answer your science questions is St. Mary's astrophysicist Rob Thacker, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After 11 this morning, it's your turn to sound off. We're going to the phones next hour for our very first open hour of the week. We call it Manic Monday, and of course, anything goes next hour. After the news at noon, tournament chair Anthony McNeil will tell us about the U19 Men's World Floorball Championship that opens up Wednesday here in HRM. Some 400 athletes from 16 countries will be taking part. And we'll hear another Halifax History Moment this afternoon with historian and author Blair Bead. But this hour, it's all about science. It is time now for Science Files. And joining me in the studio here this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Dr. Rob, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And how are you doing this fine morning?
Pretty good. I'm feeling fairly refreshed, good night's sleep, so ready to start a whole new week.
Yeah, beautiful day yesterday. Got some yard work done, raking leaves.
We should have
still
another really good day tomorrow as well. Should be a lot of sun, 15 degrees tomorrow too.
And you're heading out of the links tomorrow.
Well,
that's why you're hoping for the good weather.
Hopefully. Sometime late in the afternoon, yep.
Indeed. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a question for Dr. Rob here this morning, give us a call. You can also reach us via email. My email address, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a question on our Twitter handle, @TheRickHowe Show. Let's talk, since we started talking about golf and sports, how about grunting in tennis? And apparently, according to a study, grunting does have an impact on the game of tennis. Tell us more about this.
So I first sort of, well, I mean, people have been making sort of noises when they hit a tennis ball for some time. But the thing that really sort of got a lot of people talking about, I think, was Monica Seles.
Yeah.
Right? Because she would go, every time she hit it. And that particularly annoyed Navratilova. And so she would complain about it and so on and say, this is stopping people from hearing the contact of the ball on the racket. And so if you're a good player, that is a big part of knowing how fast the ball is going to travel, what kind of spin it has on it, and so on. And so some scientists decided that, you know, maybe we should actually study this. And it's not an easy thing to study, because what you've really got to do is to take a controlled situation and then change the parameters. So you can't literally take a professional and say, okay, I want you to sort of do 50% of your yell at this time or 100% of your yell at this time, because the shot will be changing from shot to shot. So what you have to do is you have to literally show people something on a screen and then sort of get the professionals to estimate how things are changing on the basis of changing the grunt that they have with the hit.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. And so they've done this, and the result is interesting. I think if you were an experienced sports person, it would be kind of what you were expecting, right? And so if I go really, really loudly when I hit something, how hard do you think I've hit it?
Well, I would think you hit it very hard.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the louder the grunt, the more people expect the ball speed to be up and so on. And so generally that's what the team found. The louder you are, the more people think you've put effort into hitting the ball, and so they estimate the ball is going further at the end.
So they'd be on the receiving end, they'd just be a little bit off with their timing, basically.
Yes, absolutely, especially if you're expecting it to come in at a certain speed. Yeah. But the flip side of that is that gives you something to, so in cricket there's this famous thing called the slower ball, where you come in and you, instead of releasing the ball out the front of your hand and using your wrist to flick forward, you actually release it out the back of your hand and slow your hand down.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And so if on top of that you put a as you release it, people will be even further fooled into expecting the ball to be thrown really hard as well.
Why not baseball pitchers? Why wouldn't they grunt then?
Well, absolutely. They could do that as well. I mean, was it change up or whatever?
Change up.
So I'm not such a great baseball expert at all.
In fact, but
I'm totally useless on baseball.
A changeup is you've got the whole motion of a fastball, but you're just holding something off a bit.
Right. So that is something you could do as well. But I mean, how much do people grunt in baseball?
I don't think they grunt at all, to be honest. And I also notice, and I'm not a big tennis fan, but when I do watch tennis, I find that the women have more of a tendency to grunt than the men. I'm not saying men don't grunt. They do, some. But I see more women grunt than men. I don't know if that
well,
makes...
Well, that could also be a product of... Well, no, actually, that's not going to work.
Hmm.
I was just wondering whether that could actually be a product of the overall pitch
maybe.
Of the grunt, whether a lower frequency pitch would be more absorbed by all of the people sitting around and so on, whereas a high frequency pitch would probably bounce around more. But anyway, I don't know. So it's interesting to ponder.
It is interesting, and it's they'll study anything these days. It seems so.
Well, this is sports psychology.
Well,
this is actually really kind of interesting and worthwhile to study, because it does speak to that whole thing of how you can disguise things and sort of like outthink your opponent and things like that. I mean,
because to me, the grunting was part perhaps a distraction, maybe to kind of get the other side off their game.
No, there is a physical element to it, of course. I mean, there is sort of an effort involved in, apparently, if you release air from your lungs, you can further activate your stomach muscles as well, because it's all the diaphragm, and you can create more space for the diaphragm and make more efficient movements with your stomach muscles too. So there are arguments for doing it physiologically.
But bottom line is, they said the louder the grunt, the further the participants assume that the ball would fly.
Yep.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yep.
902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Numbers to call, and Rick's given us a call here this morning. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. I grunted just before you picked up the phone there.
Well, there you go.
Anyway, my question is in the same way that E equals MC squared. By the way, there's a parrot online that actually says that. His name is Einstein. Actually says E equals MC squared. Einstein parrot. I couldn't believe it when I saw it.
The things we learn.
Okay.
But bringing it a little closer to Earth, is the total amount of water in all forms, vapor, liquid, and solid, constant on the Earth, or is there some leakage into space?
Sorry, does water leak into space? Is that your question?
Well, the total amount, do we have the same amount of water on the Earth because of gravity that we did 100 years ago, or are we losing some?
All right.
Gosh, that's a tricky question, because that relates to the escape velocity associated with the Earth and the overall velocity of water molecules. Because I know that the lighter molecules, like hydrogen, that's not leaking away very quickly at all. My gut feeling would be, and I would have to look this up just to check what the velocities are and so on. My gut feeling would, no, we're not really losing hardly any water at all into space. And if anything, I would guess that we probably have a net gain over time from mineralized asteroids that have hydrates. So they're hydrated minerals bringing water to the Earth. So that's probably the case, although that's not depositing it in a sort of like completely ice, liquid, or vapor form. That's depositing it all bound up in the mineral crystal. So my gut is no, we're probably not losing hardly anything at all. There might be just a tiny, tiny, tiny bit being lost, but I don't think we are. But I would have to check.
Okay, that's fine with me.
All right. We'll get back to you, Rick. Appreciate the call. Thank you. Let's go to Rob next year. Actually, Rob, can you hang on? It's 10:15. I have to take a quick break. Can you hang on a sec? Rob?
Yes.
Can you hang on a second?
Sure thing.
All right, you stay there, and I'll get right to you. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Dr. Rob Thacker with me here on a Monday morning. This is Science Files, and we'll be back with more right after this. Coming up to 10:19, Dr. Rob Thacker with me here for Science Files this morning, and Bob's on the line, wants to ask us a question. Hey again, Bob, thanks for hanging on.
How are you doing, gentlemen?
We're doing fine,
good, thanks.
Thank you.
Dr. Rob, last week when I called, I called about the traveling in space and how long it would take and everything else, and one thing we agreed upon is one of the things that they have to do in the future for space travel is to have artificial gravity.
That would be a good idea, yes.
Yes. And what I was thinking, that when you say artificial gravity, I think it blows me away, is that how they're going to do it. And they must be doing a lot of studies on it now, and I guess the space station would be a good testing place. But what do you know how far they went or what they're doing and how they would be able to create artificial gravity? And that's my question.
Okay.
All right. Appreciate it, Bob. Thanks
so much. So there is only really one answer to this. And so we can't create artificial gravity by any other method other than spinning something around and using the centrifugal force to actually create the appearance of gravity. And so this is something that's well known. The best example of this, I think, of like what would be a reasonable thing to do is the spinning space station in 2001.
That's right, yeah. Right?
And that is actually sort of like fairly close to what we would imagine. What would be unlikely is for us to spin things fast enough to get fully up to Earth gravity, because that would require really very strong materials to do that. And so one of the things that would be interesting to figure out, and one of the things that I think that in the sort of like next 100 years is something that we will spend a lot of time looking at. I'm sorry, it's not going to go very fast, but it's going to take time, is how the body responds in different levels of gravity. And if we can find a level of gravity that actually kind of helps the body work close to normally, then we would probably, that would be really useful to know, because then we could actually start building spaceships and so on to actually mimic that particular level of gravity. If it turns out we actually have to have all the way up to 1G, what we call the Earth's gravity, God, that's going to be tough.
So we haven't been able to recreate gravity, basically, then.
So the same thing that we use to create G's when we're training pilots in centrifuges, we would actually be doing exactly the same kind of thing, but in space, right?
Okay.
Right. And so you don't have to do anything particularly clever to do this, right? If as long as you build your spaceship strong enough, right, you can literally spin it end over end as it travels. There's no friction in space. And that's not going to cause a problem, right? So that would work. And in fact, there have been a number of proposals to do that. But it does mean that the net gravitational acceleration you feel changes as you go from one part of the ship to the other. As you go to the middle, you don't feel anything in the middle. And then as you go to the outer edges, you feel more and more.
So it would be good to have that kind of system for a trip to Mars, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, people have proposed that for trips to Mars as well. But like I said, I mean, the problem right now is we don't know enough about the medical side of things to know, could we survive in zero G for 7 months or something like that? And so we've seen that, for example, with the space station and Scott
Kelly.
Scott Kelly, exactly. Yeah. So there we know that people don't actually suffer too badly, although bone density is an issue, muscle wastage is an issue, and so on. One of those we can actually do a fair amount on. Obviously, exercising helps with muscles, but bone is a significant issue. And so one of the biggest concerns is you put people in a tin can, send them to Mars, and then they get there, and they're literally not in any state to do anything.
Yeah, because what, about a nine-month journey there,
seven months on the planet,
and then a nine-month journey back, and that's an awful long time.
It's a long time. One of the interesting things I thought with Scott Kelly was, because he had been up into and had a long stay in zero gravity before, when he came back, he kind of knew what his body was going to be like. And one of the amazing things to see him do, I don't think enough people realize how amazing this was when he had taken the jet back, he walked down the staircase by himself.
Oh, really?
Which was amazing.
Because typically they carry
impressive.
Them out of the capsule.
Yes. So I mean, I think he was carried out of the capsule when he came down. But nonetheless, when he was arriving, I think it was a German Air Force base, actually. And so he literally walked down the stairs. And so I was really impressed by that. So it may be that there are certain mental conditioning you can do to cope with that. But nonetheless, it's a significant issue.
And I think we pointed out last week that his body had basically shrunk a wee bit. Because of that time and space, and has since...
It's the other way around.
Okay.
Your body actually grows because your spine extends out, right? And then shrinks back when you come back.
He's back
down
to normal now, basically, because they compared him to his identical twin brother and, again, made that discovery. So part of the, again, the ongoing...
Get to call him short stuff.
ongoing studies about lengthy times up in space. Let's go to the phones. Donna's on the line with a question this morning. Hi, Donna.
Good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing this morning?
I'm not getting over the cold, but I'm surviving.
Good.
And Dr. Rob, how
Hi.
Are you?
Hi. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
That's good. I'm not too bad, thank you. And I'm glad you're talking about space and science, because I have a question that's been eating away at me forever.
Okay.
And it's a question of, what responsibility and ownership does the space race, the government sending the rockets up into outer space, what ownership do they take in global warming, because the emissions from these rockets has to come down somewhere, you know, like a car. It has to give off exhaust. So that's my question. I want to know what the exhaust from these rockets, what it does to the climate change and where it goes.
Thank you, Donna.
Totally great question. And it's actually one that we have talked about a little bit before. So basically, the emissions from a rocket, a fairly big rocket, are about sort of like 15 or 16 jumbo jets. Right.
Yes.
And so that sounds like a lot. Right. And but what you got to realize is, there's only really a half a dozen of these launches a year for the really big rockets. And then you've got literally thousands of jets up in the air every single day, right? Yeah. So the fact of the matter is, their contributions to global warming right now are completely negligible, right? Okay. If we had rockets going up every day, then yes, we'd start sort of like thinking about the issues there. And the other incredible thing is, potentially, we can actually build rockets with their exhaust fumes is water, right? You can actually power them with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. NASA is working on their next big rocket, and its exhaust will literally be water.
Oh, that'll be good.
Very good. Yeah. Well, not to hold you up, but I just wanted to know, but when that first rocket goes up, and I'll say way back when they started this, well, rockets, when not the little spud nuts and things they sent up years ago, like the Russians and that, but the first time that went through the ozone layer, did it break it? Did it do anything? Did the blast, the vibration, anything of that sort have to do with the ozone layer? Pardon me, the ozone layer. I can't talk because of this cold. breaking up. That was another thing in my mind, too. Did it break the ozone layer when it went,
It's really not going to have really any effect at all on the ozone layer. You're just literally flying through the air around it, and all of the ozone around it is literally going to be pushed aside and then come back down after the rocket has gone. It's not going to have an impact on that.
Well, thank you. I'll have a good night's sleep tonight.
Well, there you go. Yep. Indeed.
Rest up.
Thank you very much for answering that. You guys have a good day.
You too. Thanks for the question, Donna.
Okay. You're welcome. Right. Thanks for taking my call.
No problem. Bye-bye. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Dr. Rob is with me here on a Monday morning. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University, and this is Science Files. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, we'd love to hear from you. Brian, stay there. We'll get to you in a moment. But first, we have to take a quick break here in a moment. We've got a news update to come here for you at the bottom of the hour. Then more with Dr. Rob. And again, the number's 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also email us, rick.howe@news957.com, or tweet us a comment at The Rick Howe Show. We'll be back to hear more from Dr. Rob on Science Files after the news, and it is coming up next. Coming up now to 10:33, it's a Monday morning, and Dr. Rob is with us here for Science Files till 11 o'clock, and all you have to do is give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255, just like Brian has done here this morning. Morning, Brian.
Morning. My daughter asked me a question the other day, and I didn't really know how to answer it. I gave an answer, but I don't know if it's right. She asked me, if there was the ability to drill a hole right through the moon, so you could see right through the other side, and you took a rock and dropped it in that hole, would it go out the other side, or would it just go all the way to the middle and just float there?
All right. So that is a great question. And that's actually a problem that I set in my third year class on what we call classical mechanics.
How old's your daughter, Brian?
Yeah.
She's 23. It's just something she was thinking about.
Yeah. So there's also the remake of Total Recall, I think, with Colin.
Yeah.
Farrell, is it?
Yeah, I think, believe that's it.
So they have exactly the same idea, except it's going through the Earth, not the Moon. And so the short answer is, after all that lead up, that if you neglect air resistance in the tube itself, and you could magically keep the tube open, which actually you probably couldn't anyway, but anyway, nonetheless, if it was there, you would actually go all the way through and come out just at the other side and basically sort of like hover there and then come all the way back and keep on going. Yeah, yeah.
And if it gets to the top, it'll go back down again?
Yep, it will keep going backwards and forwards. It's what we call an oscillator, but there are all of these other things like air resistance that mean actually you would end up losing energy and so on, so you wouldn't actually be perfect going up and going back down. But the overall idea, if it was sort of like perfectly frictionless and so on, then yes, you would go all the way down, just sort of poke out the other side and then come all the way back again.
You have an answer now, Brian.
Yeah,
so if it was a moon and there's no air, right, no atmosphere on the moon, so there would be no...
Yep, good point. Sorry, I forgot we were talking about the moon. So yes, absolutely. If you if you had a completely evacuated tube, then sure, it would go down without feeling any kind of loss and would come out basically on the other side. Yeah.
Hmm.
And if you, just my own curiosity, if you threw that rock with some force, would it not come back and go round through and keep going?
So what would happen then is that it would essentially be, you can imagine turning around and throwing it up, and then it coming back down again, and you would get exactly the same thing whether you threw it down or whether you threw it up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
Cool. Thank you.
All right, appreciate it.
Yep.
Thanks. Bye-bye. The things people think about.
That is actually something I thought about when I was a kid, to
really?
Be honest. Yeah. No, really. Because I remember seeing something. There was a movie called China Syndrome. Where
nuclear
reactor, if it melts down, it's going to tunnel all the way through to China. And I was like, well, what would it be like if there was a hole through the Earth? What would happen then? So I was thinking about it for a long time. And so that's kind of, actually, that's why I set it as a question, because I've been so interested in it since I was a kid.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
David has a moon question for us as well here this morning. Wonders what you think about a base on the moon. He says it has low gravity, not zero gravity environment, so it must be good for research, he thinks.
Yep. So I'm...
Well, here, let me add this to this question. They're talking about building a space station to orbit around the moon. Why not build right on the moon itself?
Because it's harder, right? The short answer is it's fairly straightforward. It's not totally easy. Come on, it's rocket science after all. But putting something into orbit is easier because you don't have to worry about landing. As soon as you start worrying about landing, then you make things more difficult. And so China has said that they do want to have a base on the moon. My personal opinion is that the proposed Lunar Gateway, and actually that's a little bit of a joke now because the US has said that they want to go and actually land on the moon by 2024. The Gateway, they'll still do it, but that's the secondary thing. And that makes Canada look like a bunch of newbies because we said we sign on for the Lunar Gateway and so on. But anyway, so I actually think that it would be more interesting to have something on the moon itself because you would learn about working in low gravity, not zero gravity, working in low gravity environments. But more importantly, excuse me, working in the lunar regolith, which is not nice material. That's all of the dust and essentially volcanic material on the surface of the moon. That is not nice stuff to work with. That is something that we will have to work with in the future. And I think we need to start learning how to do engineering for that right now. I mean, they're, as silly as it may sound, that even the little things like what happens if you get regolith into sort of like things that you're using as lubricants and so on, what does that do to mechanical things? That is an important thing that we need to work through, right, to actually work in the lunar environment. So I would personally rather see us putting efforts, if we're going to go to the moon, actually I'd rather go to Mars at the end of the day, but nonetheless, going to and building a lunar gateway as a stepping stone into deep space I think is reasonable. But if you really want to know about working in lower gravity environments, then the moon is the obvious thing to go and look at.
Okay. Ken has another space kind of question for us here this morning. Hi, Ken.
Hi, yeah. Just 2 points. Number one is the SpaceX's Dragon rescue capsule crashed a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happened? And number two is a year from now, Plobus, this large asteroid, is going to come within 19,000 miles of Earth. And it's going to be so close, we're going to be able to see it in the daytime. Just what does he know?
All right.
Okay. So bye-bye. I have not had a chance to study the quote-unquote anomaly of the SpaceX capsule, and I don't know whether they actually have yet released what the precise cause was. What is very, very clear is that this is absolutely not SpaceX for six.
Yeah.
And it's really disturbing because... this kind of absolute failure like that, catastrophic failure, even though they called it an anomaly, is a very, very significant issue for them because everything that they've achieved so far, they've achieved without flying humans. And lo and behold, they're doing tests of their escape system and serious problems. So short answer is, sorry, I'm not up to date enough on what the precise issue was with that. But a number of people have said it's really rather unusual to lose it before. I think they actually lost it before they'd even fully ignited the system as well. So real cause for concern there, although there are alternatives. Obviously, Boeing has the ST-100 as well coming on. But as for the asteroid, I think you're talking about Apophis. And so that is scheduled to come, I thought it was 2029, not 2019, was the close approach. I'll have to check. But anyway, it's going to come just within the distance that geosynchronous satellites have. So
we'd be able to see it with our eyes?
We won't be able to see it during the day. That's not true. It'll be about magnitude 3, which, what does that mean? That means it would be a bit like a faint star, something that you could just see if you got outside of Halifax. If you're in downtown Halifax, I'm pretty sure you wouldn't be able to see it. It won't be bright enough. Right. But no, it's close as things go in terms of astronomical measurements, because we sort of tend to think that close is Earth moon distance. This is literally going to be passing us by 1/10 of the Earth moon distance. So this is still close. But don't worry, it's definitely not going to hit us. We know that absolutely.
OK, good, yeah. Good to hear that. Here's Melissa on the line with a question this morning. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Rick.
You have a question for Dr. Rob here this morning.
I do, Dr. Rob.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi. Okay, here's my question. So this morning I woke up to CBC and they had the mayor of Iqaluit, Nunavut, on, and they had the mayor of Churchill on, and they were talking about the permafrost defrosting. Mm-hmm. Pipes are now shifting, mm-hmm. breaking because nature's freezer is now defrosting. So my worry is this. I'm extremely unsettled because the climate, global warming, climate change. And so now, are we going to see, because of this defrosting of the permafrost, are we going to see airborne...
viruses and such.
Viruses and stuff, yes, exactly. And are we going to see things that could potentially... cause humanity at risk?
Okay, good question. And indeed, I just showed Dr. Rob during a commercial break a story that suggests that permafrost in some areas of the Canadian Arctic is melting so fast it's gulping up the equipment that was left there to study it. What about the risk of, again, viruses that may have been buried in the permafrost for centuries escaping into the air and perhaps being a risk to humans?
I really wish I knew more about this. My gut reaction is, yes, there's always that possibility. I mean, this happens when we see new viruses come through and so on. And the other thing to remember with this particular situation is they may not have been bad for people that were alive
then.
Hundreds, well, tens of thousands of years ago, let's put it that way. And they could be bad now. But I would have to understand what the exact timeline is on the actual creation of the permafrost and so on, and when that was last in a situation where it was microbially active and so on. I mean, I haven't thought about this, so I'm not giving you a particularly good answer. And I'm sure that there are researchers who have looked at this, though. In general, for the immediate time frame, I think the bigger concern is what Rick has mentioned, which is actually the CO2 emissions.
Yeah,
it says that could come out of the permafrost.
This is a biologist who's with the University of Guelph, who's been studying this matter, and she warns that the rapid melt could dramatically increase the amount of greenhouse gases released from ancient plants and animals frozen within the tundra. So that seems to be the bigger issue.
So, I don't know. Ancient viruses is a really interesting idea. I mean, these have come out of glaciers, I believe, as well. So it's kind of interesting to wonder about it.
Actually. Yeah, really.
I don't know. I'd have to sort of look this up, but I'm sure people have looked into it, and there is research existing on this as well. I'm sorry I can't give a better answer.
10:44 is our time. A little bit of astrophysicist humor, perhaps, from Daryl here this morning.
Okay.
Where are black holes most commonly found, he writes?
Okay.
In black socks.
Oh.
And how does one astronaut on the moon tell another astronaut that he's sorry? He apologizes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We need a
drum roll. At least he didn't do the one that had astronauts organize a party.
Okay, I'll bite. How?
They plan it.
Let's quickly take a break here. 10:45 is our time. Dr. Rob and Science Files here on a Monday morning. We'll be back with more right after this. 10:47 and more breaking news out of the UK here this morning, where it's a boy. Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have now welcomed their first child. And again, it's a boy, so we say congrats to them. And aren't you thrilled, Rob?
I'm very happy for them. Yeah, I wonder what the name's going to be.
I don't know. The bookies were taking all kinds of bets on it, so mm-hmm. I haven't seen anything yet indicating what the child's name will be. But again, it's a boy.
It's a boy.
So, there you go. Yeah. Maybe when the boy gets a little older and he visits the dentist, he'll be able to take advantage of these...
Just before we go there. So I was really intrigued by this question about viruses and bacteria coming out of permafrost. So I did a little sort of like research. I just had time to do it during the break. And so one of the really interesting things that's happened recently is that there was the Siberian permafrost started melting. Yep. And so that actually released anthrax spores. Wow. And cause some human deaths due to anthrax as well.
That
is something to actually be concerned about. So there is, as I suspected, a lot of research going on in this, and it's something that we will see what can happen. So one of the things that researchers do say is not all bacteria can survive being frozen for a long time, but some can. It's entirely dependent upon the type of bacteria, and obviously viruses would be much more capable of surviving for a long time. But a little bit disturbing, actually.
Yep. And again, basically a rapid melt underway in the permafrost.
Yep.
We'll see how that all goes. All right, let's talk about these, what do they call them, micro robots. Again, I've got a dental appointment on Friday. It's a teeth cleaning, and they're going to use that pick, and they're going to pick away at the plaque.
Yeah, it's just horrible.
It is horrible.
Yeah.
But these microbots seem to be, again, the answer perhaps to the next step, I guess, in technology. These little microbots that will be inserted into your mouth, and they'll do that job.
Yeah, no. So this is actually really interesting because this is a collaboration between some material scientists and some people working in dentistry research as well. So this whole idea of like plaque and so on in general, this stuff that you get occurring on your teeth that can be just like goopy and horrible. Those are called biofilms, and so removing them is actually a really important part of dental hygiene. So people have been looking at this. This isn't the first time people have looked at sort of like nanoparticles for actually taking this off. But what's really interesting in this new collaboration is now you have the dentists who are actually looking at the kind of things that you need to actually really effectively remove the biofilm. So you need a little bit of some chemicals coming in that are just sort of like going to basically dislodge the microbes off of one another as much as anything, as well as the tooth themselves. And so then the material scientist said, well, we can do this actually with nanobots, and we can steer them with magnetic fields.
Oh, really?
Right?
Okay.
So this is actually really cool. So the proof or the demonstration of this concept was actually in beakers, and they put stuff, biofilm in a beaker, and then put the little robots in and then use the magnetic field to move them around and actually get rid of it. And so what they're talking about now is actually commercializing this into a mouthwash. I'm sure everyone's used to doing mouthwashes. The fluoride one is the common one that we have, like swish that around for a minute or two, and then you get all the fluoride into your teeth. So what they're saying is you could have this mouthwash, you would put it in your mouth, you're not going to swallow it, obviously, and then they'll basically move the things around using some kind of magnetic field to control these things. So I think that's really interesting. Is it going to happen? Well, in this particular case, it's a question that they still have to do more research, although they have done it already on a single tooth. So they've shown that they can do it on a single tooth. So,
and I'm reading here in short, it says it worked very well.
Yep.
The micro robots not only degraded and broke up the biofilm, the plaque and material, the gunk that accumulates on your teeth, but they also dragged the degraded gunk out with them, leaving no trace of a biofilm behind.
Right. So these are iron oxide, so literally rust nanoparticles as well. So
fascinating.
Yeah, so I'm curious to see this because I'll tell you, I would much rather do something like this than have someone poking around with those things in my mouth.
I may have to cancel my Friday appointment. But
no, Rick, you have to do it. You have to do it.
I know.
It's one of
important.
Those things you have to put up with.
Yes, indeed.
I hate it when they stick it in your gum. That's
I know.
What really bugs
me. They miss it. I go, oops. Alexander writes, he read a recent article about NASA having a conference on preventing asteroid strikes. Apparently, NASA did a simulation. He says it didn't go well because New York City was destroyed. He says his question is, are we close to a point where we can actually intercept asteroids that might hit the Earth, or is that still a theory? What is Alexander?
Well, I mean, we look, if people were prepared to spend the money, we could build systems to actually do this. But people are not prepared to spend the money. People do a lot of talking about it and don't want to spend a whole lot of money on sorting it out. The problem remains that it's very low probability, but if an event happens, then the potential for damage is extremely high. But to be honest, one of the bigger problems is that for the sort of like kilometer, handful of kilometer things, we think we found pretty much most of those. And we know a lot of the orbits for those systems. The challenging thing is when you get down to things that are about 100 meters across, and they're so small, moving so quickly, that it's really kind of tricky to find these things before they come and hit you. So everyone probably remembers the Chelyabinsk meteor from about 3 or 4 years ago,
yeah.
Right? That's something we think was probably 20 meters of size, and we had
no idea.
No idea. And so something like that isn't too bad, but something 10 times bigger in terms of diameter, that's going to start doing damage, serious damage, like nuclear weapon level damage. And so those kind of things, they're on the borderlines of being able to detect them, but we don't have any way right now of actually deflecting one of those. And so the big thing that we're concerned about, though, is the really big asteroids. And at the moment, what we're trying to do is just find them. Right. So that's where we're putting our efforts. We're trying to find them. And then once we've done that, then we can move on to the next stage of knowing what we want to do in terms of actually building things that deflect them off target. The main thing is getting things early enough. That's why so much effort is going into finding these things and predicting their orbits as well.
Just reading here a story, again, breaking news in regards to the rugby situation here in Nova Scotia, that despite an order from the Education Minister on Friday to reinstate high school rugby, the Nova Scotia School Athletic Federation Board of Governors says that issue not yet resolved, and any games played are at the discretion, it says, of school principals, because the NSSAF considers rugby now to be a non-NSSAF sport. You've played rugby, have you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. So, and in fact, I'm a big rugby fan. So I followed a fair amount of the recent studies on this. And one of the challenges with rugby is, if you tackle correctly and you tackle low, then the concussion situation is not too bad. Unfortunately, if you tackle high, which has become a new thing in rugby over the last sort of like probably decade, it's become a really big thing, particularly at the highest levels, to actually what's called win the gain line and knock people backwards. And so we're seeing higher tackling in rugby, so much so that all of the World Rugby Association has actually clamped down on high tackles, is also clamping down on what's called the tip tackle, where you actually pick someone up and dump them down on the ground because they're essentially defenseless once you pick them up. And so there has been a lot of research done on overall concussion levels, which do seem to be getting worse in rugby at the highest levels. But that seems to be a function of the nature of the collisions and the nature of rugby tackling changing, which is something that should be cause for concern. But at the same time, you literally cannot hit someone in rugby the same way you hit people in football, right? Because you don't have the padding. You will hurt yourself if you do that, right? Now, admittedly, you can have people who are crazy and literally do hurt themselves, but it doesn't take long for you to realize you're not going to carry on doing or playing the game at a reasonable level if you tackle that way. So with rugby, as long as people are tackling low, it's no sport is perfectly safe. You can get a concussion playing soccer. Right. But at the end of the day, it's about making sure that the people who are playing the game are properly trained on how to tackle properly. In fact, when I was a kid growing up, we literally spent 3 weeks learning how to tackle properly.
Yeah.
Right. We've spent 3 weeks. Right. So that was probably 20 or 30 training sessions on learning how to tackle before they would even let us play a game. Right. Other than flag rugby, where you're just pulling a flag,
up. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the amount of injuries in high school rugby here in Nova Scotia, if you work it out, works out to about less than one injury per team per year.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't seem to be, a huge number.
That's surprisingly low to me, to be honest. But I would say in a situation like this, I'm sure there are reasons for the NSSAF making their decision, but I would be interested to see a bigger debate on that.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of the reason I think that Zach Churchill, the education minister, intervened, is because there was no consultation. This was just an announcement from the NSSAF on Thursday, we're pulling the plug, and that was it. And so,
well, I'm sure that they have their reasons, but it's good to have a discussion about this because, like I said, this There are any game is dangerous, and I will admit that rugby, particularly with the high tackling that I've seen going on recently, and particularly in rugby league, right? Rugby league is different from rugby union, and amazing sport nonetheless. But there is a big thing about physical confrontation on the game line, and it's kind of gone in a direction where you can see whiplash injuries happening as well from the tackle.
Well, it's the problem they're dealing with in football as well. At the professional level, in the NFL, for example, the head hits, helmet to helmet head hits.
Yeah, that's absolutely insane.
It really is. Yeah. Dr. Rob, time is up here. Another hour flies right by. Good to see you again, and thank you very much.
It has flown by. Okay, great.
Have a great week, Dr. Rob.
And you, Rick.
All right, and we'll see you next Monday. Dr. Rob Thacker and Science Files with us here on a Monday morning. It's now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off here this morning. We've got an open hour coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday, and anything goes. And our phone lines await your calls now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll take your calls after the news. The news is coming up next.